Planet FM is a platform that champions diversity. Not all our programs reflect the views of the station. We encourage you to consider a wide range of information from trusted sources when making decisions about your health.
This program is sponsored by Global Health Clinics in Takapuna, your holistic and complementary health clinic on Auckland's North Shore. Global Health Clinics support top-of-the-line experts and practitioners in their field who use a creative blend of integrating contemporary and alternative methods together to bring about greater well-being or the healing you have been seeking. Cover naturopathy, state-of-the-art blood analysis, nutrition, toxicity testing, with a comprehensive focus on cancer and prevention, yoga, Ayurveda, counselling, hypnotherapy, osteopathy, body talk, meditation, massage and energy healing, plus conscious cooking classes which we all want to learn for more vibrant health. Global Health Clinics have a vast knowledge of healing modalities and therapies that suit every individual. Our web is globalhealthclinics.co.nz, phone 488-0208. My name is Fee Rutland. I'm a natural practitioner and I work there too.
This is Bruce Lipton and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. Today we are in the culminating stages of both 2012 and in particular the Great Mayan Long Count Calendar. That instills in us a profound question. How did the Mayans time it that we, as an Earth society, would be in such a self-reflective quandary regarding our economy, ecology, and global societal pressures in general? Why did they complete a 3,000-year-plus calendar that showed us as a humanity on the crest of multiple tipping points and thresholds? Yet, with instant global media, especially the World Wide Web, also full of promise of a grand initiation of the human race to exponential knowingness of who we are as a consciously awakening humanity. What 2013 offers, we do not know. However, the imperative is for us to be strong-hearted, clear of mind, and realize that we are all very connected and share the same breath that our planet Gaia miraculously produces for all biota to share. The fact is that we have so much possibility and opportunity for transformation of our human culture to one of love, and that we can imagine and envision by actualizing possibilities as co-evolutionary co-creators and start to consciously shape our fast-coming future. This ideal we need to feed, especially for the sake of our children and grandchildren. Here on the home front, it has been a very productive year for Green Planet FM, and I've been supported ably by Lisa Eyre and Dennis Frank, who have filled in for me as to free me up from having to devote a day of each week to this voluntary radio program. We are indeed so fortunate to be able to live in this green and verdant country, as we here in New Zealand intuitively know that we are a major food basket for the world at large. As a young country that has been extensively deforested to be replaced with intensive dairy farming, plus sheep in the high country, as well as beef farming, we have been able to ride on the back of farmers working 24/7 to keep produce flowing from the land to markets both within and outside of our country. Without the farmers' good returns from our exports, New Zealand would not be in the relatively strong situation that we are in, and that has been comparatively stable as we go into the Christmas rush with cash registers ringing to the tune of Santa's ubiquitous beckoning. However, there's also a downside on our heavy reliance on our primary producers, and that is what we're taking from the land and what we are not putting back. A very knowing friend recently said to me that we are mining the land and we are using cows to do it. They are the ones who are eating the grass, and the grass is pulling all the minerals out of the soil. But we are not putting back the correct balance of minerals other than the basic NPK of nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium, and of course lime, and we are most definitely missing in calcium, for example, and many other trace elements. This is resulting in an imbalance in the soil and the soil's microbes of bacteria and fungi. The soil is becoming sour and acidic. As you know, we have four main physical elements: earth, water, air, and fire. As our planet is comprised of earth, water, and air, with the light and warmth of the sun being outside of the orbiting earth, everything is based on balance, be it the amount of different gases in the atmosphere and the volume of water that falls as rain, to the intricate equilibrium of the 88 naturally occurring elements of the earth. And for aeons, the natural order of events has produced the necessary requirements for life. However, now with 7 billion humans, over a billion motor vehicles, huge swaths of land deforested, drained, and covered in tarmac, concrete, and buildings, we are being jerked up by climate change and earth changes to reevaluate what we humans are here for. An old adage states that the reason for existence is for us to find out the reason for existence. But we have become too distracted from this. Or the great ancient Greek axiom, know thyself and you'll know the universe, now regrettably falls on deaf ears, flat screens, and a homogeneous humanity constantly looking outside themselves for an answer, or at least a distraction. Yes, balance is breathing in deeply and then breathing out, all in reciprocity of giving and receiving. Just like harvesting of fruit, then feeding the tree's roots with compost, and closing our eyes for a time for self-reflection and meditation, before once again looking at the magnificent world that surrounds us. Yes, solstice is here, when the sun is at its zenith and light bathes our hemisphere with summer radiance and warmth. A time to rejoice, relax, breathe in the fragrances of flowers, and bathe in cool waters to refresh our being for yet another year to come of both wonder and challenge. Wishing you a merry Ohutukawa Christmas and a happy new year. On the phone from Indiana in the USA, I have Arden Anderson. He is a PhD and also a doctorate in osteopathic and holds a bachelor's degree in agricultural education. He currently works in general preventive and nutritional medicine, as well as consulting for some of the world's most progressive farming operations on our planet in relationship to biological agriculture. So, kia ora, and thank you very much for coming on the show here in New Zealand, Arden.
You're welcome, Tim, and thank you very much for having me.
I'm extremely pleased. Arden, you've been to New Zealand and have built up a following with New Zealand farmers on incorporating biological systems of agriculture that does not rely on huge amounts of chemical fertilizers, etc. Could you tell the listeners here how you came into the understanding of biological agriculture and how it has brought you to here to New Zealand, and finally, what are you endeavoring to achieve in this country over the longer term?
Yes, certainly, very much. I'd love to share that. Well, it's really kind of, for me, an automatic progression in my life. I was raised on a dairy and crop farm in Michigan, and my father and grandfather were already open relative to observation in nature as far as what did cattle need. For example, my grandfather, when the cattle went off milk a little bit, he would turn them out into the meadow, recognizing that they needed to eat some of the wild herbs in order to settle their stomachs and get them back on milk. At the same time, he also recognized that nutrition was very much correlated to animal health, and subsequently my father then, who became a dairy farmer, recognized the same thing. And interestingly enough, my father's annual budget for medications, veterinary visits, and so on was less than the average monthly veterinary bill of his neighbors. And yet he had one of the best dairy farms in the state of Michigan all through the 1970s. So that was kind of my introduction. My father taught me nutrition is correlated to animal health. We just didn't have a lot of breeding problems. We didn't have a lot of retained placentas. We didn't have a lot of issues with mastitis, with foot rot, all of those kinds of things. We just didn't have them. And so when I ended up going to University of Arizona, I took a dairy science course, and the professor there was talking about all of these different kinds of health problems in dairy cattle, from foot rot to placenta problems to reproductive problems to all kinds of things. And I thought, my goodness, why do they have all these problems? We didn't have all these problems on our farm. And so as I went through my university degree in soils, water, and engineering, and then eventually agriculture education, I recognized that, gosh, what I was being taught to teach really wasn't working that well in the real world. We were seeing already in the 70s resistant weeds to herbicides. We were already seeing insects that were resistant to insecticides. We were already seeing infections resistant to antibiotics. That's what I was being taught in the university. And also, we were observing it on the farm as well, relative to weeds and some of those kinds of things. So I began asking more and more questions that, well, why is it my experience on the farm with my father and grandfather was so contrary or so different than my experience at the university or what the universities were saying was the norm? Fortunately, I happened to read a little brochure, a little booklet called The Farmer Wants to Know, written by Dr. Dan Scow, a veterinarian out of Minnesota, and Dr. Carrie Reams, who was world known as a biological farming expert and consultant. And so in reading that, he answered some of these questions about, well, why do we really have weeds? Why do we really have insects? And most importantly, talked about how if these things are truly healthy, in other words, crops and animals, we don't have the diseases. They simply do not exist. And that comes back to basic nutrition in the field, in the soil. And so I ended up going to Europe as an exchange student, a dairy crop farm in the Netherlands, and saw there as well, my goodness, here we have some of the best soils in the world, drain seabed, and in 5 to 7 years, they're very effective at destroying it to the point where they have to go out and use huge deep rippers in order to be able to further farm these wonderful soils, as well as they were having all kinds of problems with nitrate levels in the groundwater. They were having more and more disease and insect problems, as well as more and more animal health problems. And so when I came back to the States after this, I taught vocational agriculture at the high school level and began integrating some of the things that I had then subsequently learned from Dr. Dan Scow, as well as then over time, I lived and traveled with Carrie Reams and got some firsthand look at the alternative, if you will. In other words, the real solution-oriented approach to agriculture, solving our diseases, our weeds, our insect problems, our animal health problems through soil. As well, I gained information through reading the Albrecht papers, and William Albrecht was an agronomist at the University of Missouri back in the 1940s. Actually, he was department head of agronomy at the University of Missouri. And he really started the major movement of the recognition that whatever is going on in your animal health herd relative to health or disease, it had to be correlated, was correlated back to soil science. And more importantly, correlated back to the nutrition in that soil. And so reading his work, he showed that he could induce or reverse brucellosis, for example, or Bang's disease, in animals simply through appropriate or inappropriate soil nutrition. So, again, further information, even coming out of the universities, that I was beginning to read and also recognize in the field. have started doing some consulting through Dr. Dan Scow. I worked for him for a while, as well as with Kerry Reams, and over time began studying the correlation from a number of different views. Dr. Phil Callahan was a professor of mine. He was an entomologist at the University of Florida, wrote a number of books, one called Tuning into Nature, that also showed insects only attack sick plants. And of course, that was blasphemy for the chemical industry to say such a thing, because most people want to believe that the only reason you have insects is because you have a deficiency of insecticide. But the reality is Phil Callahan proved, no, it's nutrition. It's because you have an imbalance in nutrition. And of course, that work then as well was correlated in France in a book called Healthy Crops by Francis Chibosso, who was a French biologist, worked for the French Ministry of Agriculture. And what he proved, the same thing that Callahan was saying in the United States, when he proved this in France, insects only attack sick plants. So in putting all those kinds of things together, I began as well integrating that into my teachings and as well as into my consulting. There's nothing like the School of Hard Knocks, of course, help you as far as being able to understand some of these things. And eventually then friends of mine said, look, you really need to go to medical school as well. Put this whole thing together so that we can make this correlation not only just from soil to plants, plants to animals, all the way through, then we need to get into human health, because ultimately human health really is correlated back to soil health. And so I did subsequently go to medical school, knowing that once I got out of medical school, finished my postgraduate training, I would eventually get into essentially biological medicine or holistic medicine as well. I am also a flight surgeon in the Air Force. I have been conventionally trained. I do use antibiotics. I do injections and those kinds of things as I seek to. But at the same time, I recognize that what goes on in my office, in my medical office, is correlated back to what has gone on in the soil. And so my approach over time, finally putting all this together really, is that the reason I'm involved in agriculture, continue to be involved in agriculture, is because I recognize as a physician that we're not really going to make major impact on human health until we make major impact in agriculture, and particularly on the farm, and improving soil health and subsequently improving pasture and ultimately animal health. So that's really where I came from that, and how I make that connection through the whole thing and understand the whole process.
Fortunately, some key people out there who have been able to point you in the right direction. At the moment, you're working with a lot of farmers in America to bring through all this new knowledge.
Well, actually, I spend about two-thirds to three-quarters of my time in the medical practice and the rest of my time in agriculture. And there are several companies here in the United States that I consult for the company. In other words, I do training seminars for them. I do field visits, and I then interact with them with individual farms. I don't do very many individual farms myself anymore. I do have a 1,500-acre citrus operation in Florida that I do personally work with, but there's only so many hours in a day and so many days in a month, and so most of my work is via companies to the individual farmers. And so, for example, next week I'll be in Iowa. We'll be teaching a two-day soils course and then a two-day conference after that. So that's primarily how I will at that time interact with their clients or people come to those courses, which is similar to what I have done in New Zealand as well, teaching courses, doing farm visits, field visits, as well as individual instruction and advisement of corporations or companies or consultants for their clients.
Arden, of course, you have a number of New Zealand farmers. When I went down to the Waikato to Matamata, my hometown, there were farmers singing your praises, and there are a growing number of them. Could you give the New Zealand audience a quick understanding of what's happening in the soil, particularly in relationship to the ammonium nitrates that have been fed into the soil, so that people get an understanding that we have been basically destroying the soil microorganisms, the bacteria and the fungi, when in actual fact we should be nurturing and nourishing them?
Well, certainly. What's happened over time, primarily because of the chemical industry impetus, and then subsequently, unfortunately, conventional agronomy just feeds into that because basically they're repeating the status quo, if you will. But the whole approach has been because of decades ago, the observation was made that, gee, if I put a little bit of urea out there, a little bit of ammonium nitrate, my goodness, I get great grass growth. The problem with that is that you may get great grass growth as far as the appearance out there, but your actual dissolved solids, your actual feed value goes down, and which that has actually been proven by the Ministry of Agriculture there in New Zealand, looking at quantity or yields of pasture over the decades. As the use of urea has gone up, the actual yields have gone down, and particularly feed value has gone down. But nonetheless, people observe that, and what's happened is over time, those are salts, and those salts over time have destroyed the carbon in the soil. Subsequently, what's happened is we get more and more runoff, and a lot of that nitrogen, because most all of it is excess, ends up with rains. You have a fair amount of rain in New Zealand, gets washed off into your lakes and streams, and so you end up with a tremendous amount of pollution in your environment as a result of the nitrogen that's been applied to the pastures. And over time, the carbon has just declined further and further and further, because the only thing they really look at primarily is just nitrogen, but NPK as feeding these pastures. And they have neglected basic nutrients, for example, most importantly is calcium and magnesium, as well as a number of the trace minerals. So what happens is that the pasture becomes less and less nutrient dense. Subsequently, the carbohydrate content of the pasture goes down. In other words, the Brix reading goes down. So you end up with a low Brix reading, like one or two Brix, three Brix, using a refractometer over the pasture. So you have high nitrogen levels, but you have low carbohydrate levels. You put that into the cow, and now she ends up with diarrhea, loose stools, because it's all nitrogen, quote-unquote protein, with very low carbohydrate. And so that ends up adding even more nitrogen back to the soil, which then as the rains come, that washes off as well. Well, then we end up with animal health problems because of that. So we end up now, the push is, oh, we've got to go to more and more corn silage in order to get the energy up in the cow's ration. Well, the bottom line is the energy is not up now because all we've done is push nitrogen and not done basic nutrition to get the carbohydrate level in the grass up. So what's happened is that we've created a biology in the soil that can only tolerate all of this nitrogen salt that has been applied out there. And we've suppressed a lot of the beneficials, just as we have then suppressed a lot of the beneficials in the rumen as well. So we have more and more problems with the cows as far as mastitis issues, as far as foot problems, as far as parasite issues, as far as breeding problems, retained placentas, et cetera, et cetera. The list keeps going on and on. It still comes back to basic nutrition in the soil, understanding that the nitrogen is only really a quick fix, like you might say cocaine is to a cocaine addict. It really doesn't solve anything as far as the overall nutrition necessary for the cow, but it does give you the feeling, oh my goodness, I'm really producing something. But the reality is it's not. And so one of the things that you have in New Zealand is you have a lot of very sharp farmers who really do care about their soils, care about what things that they're doing. And so their attraction to the information that I have taught in New Zealand is that, hey, it gives them an option to solve some of these problems that they've had. For example, the runoff into the environment. More and more communities are up in arms about all of the runoff from agriculture. And many farmers have heeded that and say, look, we got to do something different. Number two, the margins, particularly in low times of return, are not that good in the dairy industry. So the farmers have had to look for better ways in order to improve the nutrition, to improve their profit by getting better production per unit of input. And as well, they are looking long-term as far as what about their overall animal health issues, the veterinary problems, and so on. And these farms have recognized that, my goodness, if I improve pasture quality, I improve animal health and I reduce my veterinary bill. So it's interesting that what I find, and particularly in New Zealand, it's just been such a blessing as well as just a joy to come and talk to New Zealand farmers, because what I found is, one, they're very sharp farmers, but number two is that they really do care, and they really do care about the outcome of not only the milk they're producing or the meat that they're producing, but they also really care about what's going on relative to the health of their community, and being able to carry these farms on to the next generation in a healthful and sustainable manner. And obviously that's not 100% of the farmers, but in the area that you're in, Waikato, for example, my goodness, there's a lot of farmers down there. They saw what the results could be from a couple neighbors, and they took it on themselves and made it a part of their own operation.
Yes, it's really gathering steam. Arden, the microbes in the soil and how nitrogen fixing can be done more naturally with legumes, etc. Can you lead us into really what's happening so that there's more earthworms in the soil and that the microflora is the driver of life on this planet at another level?
Well, absolutely, Tim. You're spot on with that. The problem that we've had over time with all of this excess nitrogen application is that we have changed the environment as far as its conduciveness to the appropriate microbiology in the soil. As a result, and particularly just related to nitrogen fixation, the more salt nitrogen you put on, the less active these natural nitrogen fixers are going to be. A lot of people think that the only way that you get nitrogen fixation in the soil is through legumes, particularly the symbiotic rhizobium bacteria. That is only one way, and in fact, in a pasture, you're not going to be putting a lot of legumes out there necessarily. It wouldn't hurt if we had some out there, but a lot of farmers don't have a lot of legumes out there. So how are we going to get nitrogen fixation? Well, what we're going to get it through is free-living nitrogen fixers. For example, the Azotobacters are nitrogen fixers in the right genus and species of those. There are other organisms that are either free or symbiotic nitrogen fixers in the soil, in addition to the rhizobium. Now, there actually are a few species of free-living rhizobium that don't require legumes in order to fix nitrogen. And so the only way that we're going to get them out there and keep them sustainable is we've got to create an environment that is conducive for them. For example, for you and I, with our beneficial gut flora, if we're continuously taking antibiotics, that's not conducive to an appropriate gut flora, even if we're taking probiotics on a daily basis. So we have to look at the same approach in the soil. We have to stop applying all of those materials that are killing off or inhibiting these natural nitrogen fixers, these beneficials that we need out there. Number two, we then have to provide the appropriate nutrition, which starts with calcium. And more farmers are understanding calcium really is the foundation to a healthy pasture. It's really the foundation to a healthy biology in that pasture environment as well. And you can't go by pH. And unfortunately, unless they've had chemistry, or even some of them had chemistry, they just don't get it. pH is not an indicator of calcium level. It is only an indicator of the relationship between acid and bases out there. And the more we mess up that soil environment, the more it alters the pH, having nothing to do with our actual nutrient levels, and particularly our calcium and or magnesium levels out there in the soil. So our inoculation will come once we have healthy cattle. So if we don't have healthy cattle, where is that going to come from? We're actually going to have to do deliberate inoculation into the soil, and that's why we do use inoculants into our soils as part of our biological program. So we put in the appropriate nutrition. We put in then the appropriate probiotic, if you will, as well as we have to make sure then that we put in the food sources that will keep that appropriate biology active and growing. And so part of that problem that we run into in killing that is things like ivermectin or the anti-parasitics that a lot of farmers are using in their cattle. If you look at the manure, that manure now is sterile. It doesn't grow microbiology very well, and it takes a long time for that to break down. So, again, we have to think more like humans. If we take antibiotics and wipe it out, the beneficials, we've got to do something to replace those and actually re-inoculate. We do the same thing out in the soil.
Yes, I think it's so important for you to be able to talk about the intestines or the colon in the human being, because that's where all the work is done by all these zillions of microorganisms, which of course is mirrored in the same way as under the soil and that the roots of all plants require. I think it's a fantastic way to bring in soil health and human health and the correlation between the two. Also, carbon loss. This carbon then goes back up into the atmosphere when everything starts to break down in the soil because of the imbalance. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And the interesting thing about it is that agriculture has such a gift sitting in our hands here. It's called soil. And we have the capacity, we have the possibility, the real possibility, that with appropriate soil management, we can sequester all the carbon we need to right in the soil. And we sequester that through humus. But that humus process requires, one, healthy plants, two, healthy microbiology in the soil. But once we get that, we can increase humus levels over time significantly in the soil, and that is carbon sequestration.
Yes, and this is, of course, once you get the farmers into that, they may be able to put a little forest on the side of their farm or integrate it into their farm, so that can also be part of a more holistic approach by having not only animals but also trees as well as grasses to bring what you call a more dynamic environment to the being, more bird life, more beneficial insects and bees, etc.
Absolutely. It's really a holistic approach. It's a living approach as opposed to a sterilization approach to farming. And when you understand that farmers are producing food for people, they're not producing widgets for some computer somewhere. They're producing food for people. And so we have to understand that if you're going to really produce life-giving, healthful food for people, it can only be done in a life-giving, healthful environment, and that really is the holistic approach. And when we do that, we by default solve all of these environmental issues that have really become in vogue today: the global warming issue, the carbon sequestration issue, the runoff issue. All of those things are by default corrected with appropriate farm management.
Yes, you mentioned you had a Change Your World document recently that you put out, and in it, of course, you covered bombs in the dirt, is it? Bombs, beans, and dirt. You did an article on that. And, of course, in that piece there, you mentioned that there have been noted declines of up to 6 nutrients and 7 minerals in the food value, because of the declining soil. So we need these, 74 different types of minerals in the soil, and we have been neglecting those minerals by just putting in NPK in many ways.
Absolutely, and actually there's been work done both in the UK and the United States showing, and actually repeated studies in the US, showing a gradual but definite decline in the nutrient value of crops in this country. Yes, we are producing more calories per acre, per hectare, but the problem is that they're hollow calories, and we have to have nutrient-dense calories, not hollow calories, in order to be a healthy population. And unfortunately, that's part of the reason then we see the epidemic of diabetes, obesity, and a number of other problems that are related to chronic disease back to health and nutrition on the farm.
Yes, because one of the things you did mention, and I'd like you to emphasize this, you say chemical fertilizers are essential salts that suck the water out of beneficial bacteria, fungi, protozoa, and a wide array of other organisms in the soil. And then you go on, these organisms that form the basis of a food web, which conserve and process nutrient capital in the soil, are being destroyed. And this is a huge problem because farmers are then stuck with an agricultural regime that requires the continued and ongoing use of synthetic chemicals. They're basically on a treadmill.
Absolutely. And if you look at what happens when you, say, wash your hands in dishwater or you have your hands in salt water, let's say that you do a salt water soak of your hand because it's swollen or something, what do you notice? Well, you notice after a few minutes, if you're in there 10, 15, 20 minutes, have your hand in there, the skin begins to wrinkle. What's happening is with that salt, you're dehydrating the tissue. And one of the ways that we preserve things is through salting. And many people remember that before we had refrigerators and so on, the meats were all salted. That's how we preserved them, because it inhibited microbial growth. So most people understand that when they remember those kinds or listen to those kinds of old stories, well, they're true. They're not just stories, but they're old accounts of how did we preserve our food 100 years ago. Well, the same thing occurs then in the soil when you continue to add more and more salt. What is salt? Well, salt's going to be urea, ammonium nitrate, and so on. And particularly when you put them into environments where you have inadequate carbon and you don't have enough dilution that the biology then can sequester these salts and make them into organic compounds, you dehydrate the microorganisms. You make an environment that is not conducive for them to survive. That then subsequently as well dehydrates roots of the crops and subsequently then reduces the nutrient value of that whole system. And then what we see is the only organisms that are going to be prevailing that soil situation are going to be the pathogens, because they handle those kinds of environments better. For example, nematodes. Nematodes are a classic salt problem, and we see them in a lot of horticulture crops, and it's a typical classic salt burden in the soil. And it doesn't mean that they went out and put a 50-kilogram bag of table salt on the soil, but what they did do is over the years continuously adding nitrogen salts to the soil and doing nothing really about them as far as reconditioning them or sequestering them into organic compounds. And therefore, we end up creating, as I said, the environment again that is more conducive to pathogens. Of course, that's great if you're selling chemicals and you're selling things to kill those pathogens. That's great for business.
Well, there's so many variables affecting the existence of how we have to have healthy lifestyle, but a healthy soil. Because you say also that an acre of healthy topsoil contains a web of life that includes 400 kilos of earthworms, 1,000 kilograms of fungi, 600 kilograms of bacteria, 50 kilograms of protozoa, and 400 kilos of arthropods. And in most cases, it even contains small mammals. So the soil is just full of life, and yet we tarmac it over, we walk across it without realizing that beneath our feet there's this seething mess of biological activity that is beneficial for not only us, the planet, the atmosphere. As Lynn Margulis, the great American scientist, who in many ways was so beneficial in helping James Lovelock pull the threads together for the Gaia hypothesis, that our planet is basically a superorganism. She maintains that this is one of the most fantastic components of the whole web of life.
That's absolutely correct. That potential is there. And the problem, unfortunately, is through chemical agriculture. And I'm not necessarily saying that I'm advocating that you have to be certified organic. You simply have to be holistic. You have to be biological. But But anyway, the chemical approach simply doesn't acknowledge biology from any other state other than pathogens. And they'll acknowledge, oh yeah, there's a lot of other organisms out there or whatever. Oh, they don't really make any difference unless we have a pathogen and we go and kill that pathogen. But what they fail completely to recognize, the only reason we have the pathogen is because you have destroyed the inhibitors. You have destroyed the rest of the biology to the degree that it no longer keeps the pathogens in check. So that really is the crutch of the problem. And it is reversible, however. But it takes more management, it takes more brain work, and it takes different choices as far as what materials you do put on the soil. But it can be done. Obviously, if you have talked to a number of farmers in the area down there, it can be, not only can be, it is being done by a number of farmers and an expanding group of farmers, not only just in New Zealand and Australia and the United States, but throughout the world. Even though sometimes it seems to be pretty slow, it is still happening and things are changing very well around the world.
Yes, I'm in agreement because I'm speaking with Arden Anderson on biological agriculture and the change of consciousness in all farming methods. Arden, can you just mention for some people mastitis?
Mastitis really is a infection of the mammary gland of the cow. And typically there are a number of issues associated with that. Obviously, she's had some type of assault to the udder, whether it might be over milking, whether it might be an injury, a physical injury there, or whatever it might be, and she gets an infection in there, E. coli, staph, strep, something of that nature. And so now she has actually an infection in the mammary gland. And so typically they're given antibiotics and taken off the milk line and so on and so forth. But the reality is that why is she susceptible to that to begin with? Why is she not handling the quote-unquote stress of milk production? The real reason she's not handling it is because her diet is too acidotic. It's too acid-causing. Ruminant animals are not designed to eat grain. And so what's happening is more and more we're pushing these animals with grain types of materials, silage, for example, or actually now there's a big push for New Zealand farms to become Americanized, essentially feedlot dairies, where they're feeding a lot of concentrates, corn silage, and so on, in order to push milk volume production up. The problem with that is New Zealand dairy farmers, they need to visit the United States and a few major dairies to see that the lactation average in the United States is 1.4 lactations, and that cow goes down to the slaughterhouse. And the reason for that is she's burned out.
That's 1.5 years of producing milk, and that's it, whereas on our farm, we used to have 12 years of all cows.
Correct.
Yep. Wow.
Absolutely correct. So what's happening is you're burning the cow out. So she's more susceptible to mastitis. She's more susceptible to injury because she is burned out. And you're ruining the immune system because you're not feeding her adequate nutrition. So she wants to produce milk because that's a natural process for her. So she's going to rob her own body in the attempt to try to produce more milk. Well, the interesting thing is that when I was in New Zealand a few years ago, I found out that Fonterra is the largest purchaser of micronized calcium of any group in New Zealand. Why are they a large purchaser of micronized calcium? The reason being is because the milk produced by the cows is so low in calcium, they have to actually add micronized calcium carbonate to the milk in order to bring the level of calcium up to where it's supposed to be.
Yes.
That's a nutritional deficiency on the farm. That's not in the cow. That should have been put in the pasture and fed her through that grass. She'll be less susceptible to the mastitis when we do those kinds of appropriate nutritional things.
I know that many listeners won't realize that a teat on a cow's udder will then, if it has mastitis, there'll be pus coming out from inside the udder out through the hole through the end of a teat. And often I know that I used to see penicillin in a little squeezy or squeezed up the teat. Now, of course, sometimes you don't notice that the teat may be suffering, and so you put the cups on and the milk is then taken from the cow, or she releases the milk, but she could be releasing some pus into the milk, and this is where they take a test of the milk coming from that particular farm vat, and they test it to see if there is any, what do you call it?
What they're looking at basically is somatic cell counts, and seeing how high those somatic cell counts are, which are basically our white blood cells, yes, it's pus. And depending upon the level of those, obviously if you got one or two cows out of 500, then that all gets diluted out. It still goes into the milk. It still goes into the system. Yes, they track those, and if they get above a given threshold, well, then that cow is tagged that she needs to be pulled out of the line, or she needs to be treated with an antibiotic. The problem is all you're doing more and more is creating more antibiotic-resistant microorganisms and infections, and not dealing with the underlying cause. Because one thing that we have, for example, the organic dairies in this country, they're not allowed to use antibiotics. Well, how do they survive then? And actually, it's one of the fastest-growing areas of the milk industry in this country. Organic Valley, for example, is the largest organic co-op in the United States, and they are not allowed to use antibiotics. So how do they treat those? Well, first of all, they have to go after the nutrition, so they have less problem to begin with. Number two, they're using herbal tinctures. They're using various different herbal mixtures in order to treat the animals. For example, garlic, they're using homeopathics, they may be using acupuncture, various things like that that we use also in holistic medicine in order to treat these things. And actually what they're finding is they're more effective than the drug regime, because the drug regime is creating so many antibiotic-resistant microorganisms, which are not then susceptible to the antibiotics anyway. So there are a lot of ways to address this, even after the cow has mastitis, to treat her appropriately. But also it comes back to getting that rumen set up appropriately, getting the proper biology in there, and reducing the acidosis that's going on because of too high of a concentrate diet on that cow.
Fantastic. Now tell me, how many organic farms are there in America at the moment? Any idea?
Oh my goodness. How many organic farms? I don't know that I can give you an exact number. We know that right now, as far as dairy is concerned, it's somewhere between 4% and 6% of all of the milk in this country is organic, which is not a lot, but you figure we feed 320 million people in this country, so that's still a fair amount of milk. Organic Valley, I understand, is about a $300 to $400 million company, so there's a fair amount of milk out there just in one co-op.
Well, we're very much wanting to encourage organics, but this is the beauty of biological agriculture, because it does actually open up the back door for a farmer then to migrate across into a more organic way of life, correct?
That is correct, if they so choose to do that. What I find is, for many farmers, the conversion to organic is very, very intimidating, and unfortunately it's very political as well. It does not absolutely guarantee that we have a better outcome or a better product, but it does mean that you have not used any genetically engineered products, you've not used any antibiotics, you've not used any chemical fertilizers. And what happens is in a transitional program, we may use some things that are not allowed organics, but they're still much softer on the soil, and they help us to move along getting our biology into the system. And then if a farmer gets that system operating, for example, the BRICS readings of their pastures come up, their overall production is improved, then what we have is a much easier transition to organic should they decide that they want to do that. And it just makes it so much simpler, I find. So instead of a 3-year transition, maybe we'll do a 5-year transition for them. And at least in the United States, I know it's not quite as simple in New Zealand, but in the United States, we have a fair amount of demand for new organic dairy producers. However, interestingly enough, with Organic Valley, for example, the farmer has to be able to get accepted, and the company company will come in, they'll tour the farm, they'll look at the management, they'll see what kind of soil program they're doing, they'll see what kind of nutritional program they're doing for the animals, and if they're not up to par with Organic Valley standards, they will not get accepted to sell milk to Organic Valley. So part of this has to do with understanding the holistic approach, and so if you really want to be an organic farmer, in my opinion, you really need to be a part of the best farmers, because it does take more management, it does take more brain work, yes, but it doesn't have to cost us more on a per unit basis, and in order for that to occur, it does take more brain work, it takes more management, but that is certainly attainable.
But you are so keen and you're so proud of the produce that you're producing, Arden. I mean, you're not spraying poisons over your crops and things like that. You're actually part of the web of life. You realize that your farm is an extension of a greater organism, and you have a deeper relationship with your cows. I mean, my father named every cow that he had on the herd. It was this closeness, I feel.
Right. Well, I mean, that's certainly very true, and there's all of that as well. But the bottom line is, in today's world, Tim, you have to make a profit.
That's
and
nice.
The bottom line is that a lot of those nice things come once you make a profit, and I never have to apologize for organic growers as far as the profitability and their ability to make a profit, having nothing to do with an organic premium, but everything to do with how good their management is, what their cost per unit of production. In other words, how much does it cost them to produce a liter of milk? I don't care whether or not they are an absolute chemical farmer or whether they are a fully certified organic farmer. What does it cost them to produce a liter of milk? That really is the determining factor. And the good organic farmers, it costs them no more to produce a liter of milk than it does the avid chemical farmer. But it takes more management to get there, and it takes much, much, much better nutrition to do that. And then when you're there, you are actually a part of the solution, not just the food solution issue, but you're also a part of the solution to the environmental issues, to the overall human health issues, to the local and regional economy issues, as well as certainly, yes, to the social things that you talked about as far as really appreciating that you're producing real food for your fellow human beings.
And just as a sideline, at the moment, the federated farmers here in New Zealand are being sort of seduced with GE, and there are people wishing to get New Zealand farmers on the GE bandwagon, and you have been studying this, and it's important for New Zealand at the moment to have a 10-15 year moratorium on GE because it's an immature science. That would be your understanding?
Well, the thing about it is that, I mean, this is a pretty hotly debated topic, and the bottom line is that Stalin and Hitler were pretty successful as well of convincing their majority of populations to follow them. The chemical industry is no different today, and genetic engineering, first of all, is not needed. There is no absolute scientific or economic reason from a food production system of needing genetically engineered crops. All of the hype about how genetically engineered crops are needed to feed the world is absolute lie. It's not just an exaggeration, it is a flat lie. One thing that we found out this year very, very strongly, in the United States, we had a significant drought in about 30 states of the United States. I mean, it was one of the worst droughts, supposedly, in history. Not the worst in history, one of the worst droughts in history. The interesting thing is that we got farmers right in the middle of the drought that had normal crops. The issue that finally came out, of course, the industry's trying to skirt around this, genetically engineered crops require 30 to 50% more water to grow them than do non-genetically engineered crops. So if you have an issue with water, genetically engineered crops are only going to make it worse. The other thing about it is, as far as yields, they do not increase yields. And the overall levels of yields in the United States and corn, the universities have shown this time and time again, have not increased because of genetically engineered crops. Quite the contrary, the non-GMO crops outproduce the GMO crops. So there is no reason for the farmer to fall for that lie. And the interesting interesting thing is, though, is that people get enamored with technology. They think, oh, gee, we got a new cell phone, or we have this new airplane, or we have this new car, or we have this new computer thing. People get enamored. They fall in love with just the idea of new technology. And so they think when they hear the word, oh, biotechnology, that must be great, when in fact it's not great at all. And unfortunately, people don't really pay attention. So they're promised all of these things about how wonderful it's going to be. And the bottom line is they're just promised things of not having to be responsible. Because, oh, gee, you're not going to have to worry about it. We're going to increase yield and this and that. Well, the yield is all about nutrition. You cannot make something from nothing in nature. Most importantly, what we've found is that genetically engineered crops are poisonous. No, they are not essentially the same at all. The work that just came out of France by Cirilani and his group was a two-year study. It followed international scientific standards. It was a well-done study. It was analyzed the way it's supposed to be analyzed. And because it was a two-year study, it found things that some of the industry studies only broached. And that was, as number one, 50% of all the male rats and 70% of all the female rats starting month four of the study developed mammary tumors. So tell me, how is it that you could say that a corn or soybean is quote-unquote essentially the same when you get mammary tumors from eating GMO and you do not from non-GMO? There's nothing at all similar between those two things. And most people don't want to sit by and understand really what is the cause, what is the problem. When you put a foreign genetic process together, you create a foreign peptide that the immune system of a mammal looks at and says, wait a minute, I've never seen this before, this is foreign, and you get an inflammatory response. It happens 100% of the time. It's not just occasionally, it happens 100% of the time. The immune system is going to create an inflammatory response to that genetically engineered product. The other interesting thing about Cirilani's study was it was only a 10% genetically engineered diet in these rats. Not 100%, it was only a 10% amount in that diet. So we've seen this around the world. Every animal study that's been done shows that there is a problem with an inflammatory response. And I understand a little bit of immunology going through medical school, having taken immunology. It makes perfect sense what is going on. It's not rocket science. It's basic immunology. But the industry does not want to acknowledge that because, of course, that's a big cash cow for them. One, they can patent things, and, of course, there's money in patenting things. But they also are lazy. They're just simply lazy at going at the real problem, which is a nutritional imbalance in the soil. We don't have a genetics problem. We have a nutritional problem in the system. And you think that we have cancer problems and reproductive problems now? We've only begun to see what will happen once genetically engineered crops become worldwide as opposed to just the Western world.
Thank you for that. That was really important for listeners and myself to hear, Arden. And finally, Arden, because we're running out of time, we've got 2 minutes. How do you see biological agriculture being taken on board by all farmers and gardeners and horticulturalists, etc.?
Well, I think it's one very important thing is that it works and it's profitable when it's done well. And particularly long term, the only way farmers are going to survive is they have to be sustainable. It doesn't matter what goes on relative to the government or various things like that. But in order for the farmer to be sustainable, to be able to stay in business, they cannot continue to do that which is unsustainable, which is a chemical conventional system. So farmers, once they recognize that, and more of them are, and my experience is in New Zealand, they're expanding faster than anywhere else in the world that I've been relative to accepting biological approaches. And I think it's probably just because of your culture. But once they recognize that, there's no stopping them. And that's what I've seen in various areas in New Zealand when I've been there, is that, my goodness, once the New Zealand farmer grasps the concept that, hey, this is more profitable, it is sustainable. It's something not only that is sustainable for me and my children, but also for the entire country, they take it on immediately, and you can't stop them then.
Arden, Thank you so much. Well, I've got a happy heart listening to you. That's just so wonderful. So we look forward to seeing you in New Zealand coming up in February of 2013. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. I look forward to it.
Very good. Well, I will make sure that we get as many people to become aware of what you're offering and that you will meet them here in this country.
Wonderful. Actually, we're going to do a couple of souls classes, and I'm also doing a couple of human health classes. So we'll have people there from all walks of life.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Arden.
Thank you very much, Tim, and you have a wonderful day.
I will. Bye-bye. That was Arden Anderson, and you can find him on ardenanderson.blogspot.co.nz or just do a web search for Arden, A-R-D-E-N, Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-E-N. For more information about Arden coming here to New Zealand in February 2013, phone 0800 878 343. 0800 878 343, Phyllis Tichinen. Phyllis Tichinen, or email info@truehealth.co.nz. info@truehealth.co.nz.
Hey, I was just wondering, could you tell me some more about the tonal portal stuff? Why hang a hill?